Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to the New Books Network in Environmental Studies, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Aspen Brown, the host of the channel, and I am currently an MA candidate at the University of Wyoming studying cultural history, focusing on environment, science, and knowledge. Today, we'll be talking with Dr. Lindsay Starkey about her new book, Encountering Water in Early Modern Europe and Beyond, published by Amsterdam University Press in 2020. Dr. Lindsay Starkey, welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you very much for having me.
Thank you for coming on. And on that note, as a way to start off our interviews, we always just like to have our guests say a little bit about themselves. So would you like to give a little bit of a background about yourself?
Sure. I am currently an associate professor of history at Kent State University, and as the title of the book suggests, I am an early modern Europeanist who focuses most on the 16th century. My work is typically focused around the intersection of the history of religion, specifically Christianity and Judaism, and the history of science. And in terms of teaching, I will actually start my 11th year at Kent this upcoming fall. I teach world history, upper division courses. I tease basically from the medieval warm period till Napoleon loses the Battle of Waterloo. It's kind of my upper division courses. And then some methods classes and a graduate course on the Reformation.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much for that wonderful introduction. And you're obviously very knowledgeable in those areas from the content in your book. And would you like to just introduce Encountering Water in Early Modern Europe and Beyond?
Sure, I'd love to. I'll go ahead and talk a little bit about how I came to write it, and then provide a little bit of an overview of the book's argument and the contribution that I was wanting to make with the study. I came to this topic from really two different inspirations. The first was my dissertation, which was about John Calvin and the way in which he incorporated some natural philosophical ideas into specifically his biblical exegesis, but some of his other works as well. For those who are not familiar, John Calvin was one of the Protestant reformers who's associated with Geneva, Switzerland. And in my dissertation, I had a chapter on water in Calvin's works. And he wrote a lot about how the only reason water does not flood the earth is because God keeps it back and allows for a safe space for people to live. And this was a very odd claim for the natural philosophical works that I was looking at, which suggest, you know, there shouldn't really be any kind of problems figuring out why water doesn't, flood the earth. And as I looked into some of other 16th century authors to contextualize Calvin's works, I found that they were really interested in this question of how do we end up with dry land? Whereas earlier authors, so predating the 16th century, they're not as concerned about it. And so I kind of made a note as I was finishing up my dissertation about wanting to explore this question further. The other kind of inspiration for this book actually comes from my personal history and my general interest in water. I am from northeastern Ohio, and I grew up about 3 miles from Lake Erie, so one of the Great Lakes. And actually, as a kid, I didn't realize that not everyone lived within about 10 minutes of a beach. That was a learning curve for me. And as I was away in graduate school, Lake Erie was experiencing some of the largest fluctuations in its water level in its recorded history. I believe it went from some of the lowest recorded levels to highest recorded levels in a 10-year period. And where I'm from, Geneva, Ohio, one of the parks there in the winter of 2019-2020 actually lost over 100 feet of land because of this very drastic fluctuation in their water levels. And so, you know, I was kind of interested in that personally, but I didn't really know what to do with that academically. But thankfully, I have a colleague at Kent whose name is Ann Martinez, who introduced me to the environmental humanities and the Association for the Study of Literature and the Environment. And it got me really interested in reading about the kind of the blue humanities and the ways in which cultural understandings of, you know, bodies of water, in my case, how those shape the way that people behave towards water. And so I was hoping with my book to both to pick up on the interest I developed in this question during my dissertation about why is it only in the 16th century that Europeans get so interested in water's relationship to the earth, and then trying to help as best I can as a historian with some of the water crises that we're experiencing today in the 21st century.
I really appreciate that mindfulness towards trying to navigate both the present and the past in such a graceful way. And that certainly comes through in the book. I mean, do you want to just move on from there and get into what you're arguing and why it's important?
Sure, absolutely. In terms of, I've already mentioned this, but just as a reminder, the two major questions that I wanted to address with my book were the first, why is it in the 16th century that Europeans are especially interested in the relationship between water and earth? And then the second one was, you know, how is what these authors wrote and what they did, how might that help us, right, in our current situation, deal with the climate change and honestly to try to get us to do something about it? And the argument that I made in terms of the first question, so about the 16th century, is that what really pushed these authors to be so concerned about water's relationship to the earth are the sea voyages that Europeans started to make in the 15th century to sub-Saharan Africa and Asia in particular, but then also the Americas, specifically South America, because as all these reports of these new lands and people are coming in, the other Europeans, the Europeans I studied in my book, they are thinking, hey, wait a minute, how is their land located in this area? We always thought these were supposed to be places covered by water. And so these voyages, I argue, are what sort of raise the question about the relationship between water and earth. However, Europeans then turned, the people I study are intellectuals, meaning people who have university educations primarily, they turn to the methods that they were trained with, specifically the methods of reading books from respected authorities to answer the questions of where did all this water go, or what is the relationship between water and earth. And so what I discovered in my research was that in the 16th century, Europeans are reading different ancient authorities in particular, such as Ptolemy's Geography, which has a different take on the relationship between water and earth than many ancient authorities. Many of the scholars I studied also became especially interested in Jewish exegesis in the 16th century, and you find there a different take on God's relationship to the earth. And so you find kind of these questions coming up, getting addressed through scholarship. And the final kind of piece to this argument of mine is that this is also a period of religious reformation, and there's a lot of discussion in Europe about God's connection to the universe. And so where sea voyages raise the specific question of the relationship between water and earth, the interest in reading the Bible and discovering kind of God's relationship to human beings as they perceive it in some of the natural phenomena that they interact with in the world, this really leads them to look at their traditional scholarship and some new texts to try to answer the what happened to all the water and why doesn't it flood the earth. In terms of the argument for our more modern period, what I ultimately kind of came to boiled down to the fact that, you know, facts themselves, or what we might want to call facts, these don't convince people of anything. We have to keep in mind the cultures in which people were born and the ways in which they actually learn about water in order to kind of understand and to impress upon people, or help impress upon people, how serious the modern water crisis really is. And in the book, I kind of boil it down to sort of methodology, ideology, and experience, right? So methodology for 16th century Europeans reading books, right? The ideology, so the predominantly kind of Christian and ancient background, and then reading about experiences of these voyages, they all come together to change the way 16th century Europeans thought about water. And I think if in the 21st century, if we expect people to care and to do something, we also need to keep in mind how people learn about water, what assumptions they bring about it to the table, and their experiences with it, so that we can have more fruitful dialogues. In terms of the contribution, there is a debate in my field in particular about the impact of overseas voyages on European thought. The more traditional view was that it changed everything, right? So everything changed in October of 1492. There was a more revisionist view of it not being all that important, that European scholarship continues through long-standing methods, and that Europeans understand the encounters that they're having with new peoples and new places through traditional European categories. And in my book, I'm hoping to take a middle approach, you know, talking about how, well, the voyages very much helped focus Europeans' attention on particular topics to which they then applied their traditional methods and their traditional assumptions or ideologies. There's also, in terms of the environmental humanities, there's a growing research area on how the humanities shape our interactions with the environment and what the study of the humanities can do for the environment. And so in my afterword in particular, where I talk about our modern water crisis, I was hoping to make some suggestions for that area as well.
Yeah, and if we have time at the end, I would love to hear you go into those as well. But before we do that, thank you for just the wonderful explanation there, and what insightful information about the historiographical debate that's going on about how impactful these sea voyages are, because I've actually delved a little bit into for my own research and looking at scientific methods and knowledge. I've looked at the end of the 16th century and into the 17th century. So it's really, really cool to see this the other side of it and really see how assumptions were questioned and the world changed but didn't change, and it's all kind of a muddle. But and one thing I found really interesting too, in chapter one, Athens and Jerusalem on water, you start in antiquity. Would you like to talk a little bit about your perspective on what they were thinking about water in antiquity, and then also why you decided to use antiquity as kind of this a launching point for your book?
Sure, absolutely. To start with your second question first, I decided to look at antiquity because it is a crucial part of 16th century scholars, just their intellectual world, as well as the way in which they approach the world. They would read specifically ancient authorities in order to kind of see what they had to say about a wide variety of topics, and while never bound to what these ancient authorities said, right? They could always raise questions, of course, or disagree. The starting place for scholarship in the 16th century were these ancient works, these authoritative works. And so in this particular chapter, the title actually comes from an early Christian named Tertullian, who rhetorically asks, "What does Athens have to do with Jerusalem?" Right? So why are Christians, for him, Jerusalem? Why are they studying like ancient Greeks and Romans, Athens? And in even asking that question, Tertullian was using a rhetorical device, which comes from ancient Greece and Rome, which is kind of funny. But the two go very closely together. So it's for scholars in the 16th century. And so I started out then with the ancient sources. And what I found is that even prior to the development of Christianity, there were a lot of discussions in a variety of different texts about the relationship between water and earth. But there's general agreement in the ancient period that I found broke down in the 16th century. And in these ancient works, they argue, first of all, that the universe is rational and it's orderly, right? So water and earth are parts of the universe, and they have a rational, relatively stable relationship. There's a lot of speculation in these ancient works about the actual layout of water and the land masses in the earth. There is a general agreement that there's a lot more water in the world than there is earth. They talk about the known world, which for them was what we call today Asia, Europe, and Africa, that this area is entirely surrounded by water, right? Kind of almost like a large island. And for those ancient scholars who say, well, there maybe are other land masses, they explained, but even if there are other land masses in other parts of the globe, the water makes it impossible for us to travel there, right? There's so much water. It's also, they thought, really, really hot, that if you tried to get to these land masses that we don't know about, you'll burn up in the heat. The final thing in these ancient works that I noticed is this kind of tendency, especially in Stoic and Epicurean works, to view water as a really destructive force. Like water, also along with fire, as a really destructive force. And in the latter half of this chapter, what I found really fascinating as I started to look into some early Christian works is that they take this tradition, which comes out of Greek, primarily Greek, but some Roman scholarship, and they don't really change it very much. They appropriate it and adapt it into a Christian framework. And so they say, okay, there is a rational, stable relationship between water and earth. And Christians will add, and the reason there is one is because God, on the third day of creation, commanded the dry land to appear in order to give people a dry and then eventually fertile place to live. And so they Christianize that tradition. And that is very much what the 16th century authors I study, that they inherit and that they are in dialogue with as they're working on their own work.
And that's a perfect segue to chapter two, where you analyze a whopping 38 different commentaries from both Christian and medieval Christian and Jewish contemporaries in the 16th century. And I like that's so interesting that they're ordering the world in this specific way using using religion and using God as this justification for the balances of the world. So I was just wondering if you wanted to talk more on what they argued specifically, or if you had one or two like really favorite commentators that just always stuck out to you, even though you used this wide array.
Oh, yeah, sure. So just a little bit on the argument that I was making here. So I have argued it, and as I kind of mentioned before in the first chapter, what develops out of a lot of these early Christian as well as the ancient authors is the idea that water and earth have a natural relationship to one another. Like it's part of nature. It's what happens all the time. You don't really need to worry about it too much because it's going, you know, that's the way it is today. That's the way it will be tomorrow. And what I found in the commentaries that you just referenced, Aspen, is that this idea of a stable relationship continues into the medieval period until you get to the 16th century. And you asked me about some examples. So the person I found who is most influential, even into the 16th century, is a Latin theologian who is very influential on a variety of different topics, but a man named Augustine of Hippo, who does appear in the first chapter of my book, but he's kind of a constant theme throughout. And what he speculates in his text, again, to show the natural relationship between water and earth, is that, okay, prior to the third day of creation, when God gathered the water together, sure, water covered the earth, but it covered it like clouds cover, you know, land masses, mountains, things like that. And so he says, when God says, okay, water, you know, gather together, the clouds became more dense and they started to condense and turn into the water that we experience today. And that exposes some of the regions of the dry land. He also argues additionally, so not only did we have this cloud thing going on, but there were holes, right? The earth was porous and it poured into the water. Water poured into the land, and then that allowed the dry land, at least some of it, to stick out above the water. And so these solutions are fascinating, and they're also a good example of a natural discussion because everything, right, is totally changed after the third day. The water-earth relationship is stable. And then you get to the 16th century, and you encounter someone like Martin Luther. Right, so a theologian and someone, of course, closely associated with the development of Protestantism. And he argues in his lectures on Genesis in the 1530s that, just to give you a quote, he says, quote, "It is by divine power that the waters do not press in on us." He says, "God therefore performs for us to this day, on Until the End of the World, that same miracle which he performed for the people of Israel with the Red Sea. So God, in other words, is like actively keeping the water from flooding the earth on a daily basis. And it's quite different than Augustine's, hey, it was like clouds, and then it just condensed.
It's so fascinating to see these differences in narrative, but they're well thought out, right? And it's really interesting to consider that it was just people trying to orient themselves in the world and understand their place in the world. And it's just a way different worldview than we have today. And it's just, this book was really foundational in making me kind of see the other side a little bit better, which I really, really appreciate. And one thing I was thinking of while you were talking, and also while reading this chapter, is, around the 16th century and obviously a few centuries before, we have the Little Ice Age, and we have some climate change. Do you think or know or speculate if some of these changes on the understanding or narratives behind water, are they changing because the climate is changing and the balances that they're seeing that were so powerful in antiquity and leading up to the 16th century kind of undercut or undermined because of different climate changes?
Yeah, that's a fantastic question. I think the first question, which I'm not sure of the response to or the answer to, is how aware the historical actors were at the time that this climate change was going on. There has been a lot of scholarship to show, especially in the 14th century, the 1300s, where there was quite a drastic shift from that medieval warm period that I mentioned before. Contemporaries were aware because you had bodies of water that were freezing and that had never frozen before in anybody's lifetime. By the time you get to the 16th century, I have found less of that. What they seem to be more aware of is less like climate change, and they are more aware of like severe individual events. So for example, I believe it's in the 1520s or in the 1530s that there's a huge flood of a river in, I believe it's what is today Germany, and that generates quite a lot of pamphlets. So there's a lot of discussions about it. But what I found fascinating is that kind of discussion did not end up in the exegetical texts that I write about in the second chapter of my book.
Oh, that's interesting. Why do you think that is? Do you have any thoughts?
I do. I have a couple theories, and they're connected. I think the first reason that it's not in the commentaries that I looked at is because of the ways in which the Christians in particular read the rest of the book of Genesis. So if you think about the story of Noah and the flood, at the end of that story, God promises that he will never flood the entire earth again. And so I don't think, since it was a more of a localized flood, I don't think it resonates or it doesn't register as something that could destabilize their entire conception of water. The other thing I think that's going on here, a lot of the pamphlets that I mentioned are coming from people who are what we would call today Protestant, right? So evangelical in the period, Protestant. And they are very interested in signs from God, providence, and the idea that there is a localized flood, not the big one, because God promised that's not happening again, but the localized flood was read by many people as a sign. So it's not necessarily a natural event. It's a miracle, right? God is intervening to punish them for their sins.
That's, oh man, that's so cool. And I think you really point out something important too, to that I'm talking about climate applying it to people in the past, it's obvious, you know, they didn't have that kind of language and stuff. So I apologize if I made a little anachronistic faux pas there. But thank you for your answer. It was this is just such a interesting way of approaching the early modern period and kind of going into the third chapter. You get into texts and one term that you use, I think it kind of appears throughout the book, but it's bookish methods, and it's getting into the idea of how these knowledges really transmit and are shared between these texts. And I just wanted to ask you a little bit about how those networks were formed and why people in like the 16th century granted authority to people in the past with such kind of with not a lot of doubt, I guess, or that's kind of how it seems to my end, and that could be wrong as well.
Yeah, no, this is a great question. I think well, there's people have written, you could spend your whole career on this topic, right? So I'll try to summarize my thoughts, but I think part of it, well, a lot of it has to do with, in the 16th century in particular, there is an interest in recovering ancient works because they are seen as more authentic, authentic's not the right word. They are more likely to contain truth than works that were written in more immediately, you know, contiguous centuries. So we often talk about this, the word, they don't use this in the 16th century, actually, but we call it humanism, right? So when we teach, you talk about humanism in this idea of going to the sources, right? So going back to the ancient sources and reading them directly for yourself. Because kind of building on your question, Aspen, and the use of the term bookish methods had been the way that European universities functioned, right? In order to get a degree, you would hear lectures on what were considered authoritative texts, and you would learn them, kind of learn some of the debates surrounding them. And by the time you get to kind of the 15th century, there's a lot of people who have written commentaries on these ancient texts. So what you're hearing in your lecture hall might be that commentary instead of the ancient text itself. And, you know, beginning, especially in the Italian peninsula, in, you know, what we call the Renaissance, and then spreading out from there, we start to see this interest in, well, I don't want to read the commentary from the 14th century guy. I want to read Aristotle directly and see what he has to say. And so they give Aristotle a lot of authority. I like to tease my students. I think we still, in universities, at least in history, we still have bookish methods. My question to them is, how do you know that the earth is round? And I've had some students who've actually done some of the experiments and have actually seen it themselves. But I will speak personally, as someone with training in history, I know because I've read about it in books. And these books, of course, are written by people who have scientific expertise, who have done the experiments, right? And I certainly acknowledge that. But I know that information because I personally know it because I've read it in books. And I think we see something kind of similar in the 16th century too.
Yeah, I love that. Hayden White would be mad back then too about people not going back to the sources. That's amazing. They had their own little postmodern turn that wasn't in the modern period. But that's amazing. Thank you so much for that answer, because it's so fascinating to learn about these ideas and how knowledge really does go, is this generational sealer that gets translated from generation to generation. But then it's also like one big game of telephone too, right? So did you run into any problems with like, or any issues with like missing texts where they might, somebody might reference a text that you can't find or don't know anything about?
Yes, that was the hardest research challenge for this particular work, was deciding which texts to include and which to exclude. Because as you're suggesting, theoretically, the number of texts to include could be basically infinite. Right? There's lots of things that I could have included. And so the way I built the research bibliography, so what primary sources I was going to read and analyze for the book, was I started in with the 16th century texts, and I looked at who 16th century Europeans cited. So who did they cite? And then I traced the references back from there. So, okay, they're citing, I know, for example, like Thomas Aquinas, right? So they cite Thomas Aquinas. Then I find Thomas Aquinas and find who Aquinas cites, and then kind of going from there. I also, of course, relied on other modern scholars and the works that they've done on these texts, and where they've pointed out that these works were particularly influential. And so then I also went and added them to the research bibliography as well.
Oh my gosh, that's so much work, but it's an oppressive amount of work. How many languages do you speak, and how many languages you grappled with throughout this project?
Sure. So the only language I speak fluently is English. I have a conversational and a reading knowledge of German. I can read French and Latin. And then I like to tease, I know just enough Dutch and just enough Greek to be dangerous, right? To convince myself that I can pick through this.
Sure, sure. That's awesome, though. That's because it allows you to, I'm sure, do more work, at least to be, or it's more freeing to be knowledgeable in that vast array of language as well. Well, thank you so much for that answer, because that's really interesting, and it must have been, what, did it take a long time to develop this methodology where you were building on this genealogy that you could track?
It's something that previous scholars have done before, especially when it comes to the history of exegesis, which is, as I mentioned, I was trained initially in Reformation studies. So the Reformation was my kind of major focus as a graduate student. And you find it in a lot of scholarship there, especially for those who do intellectual history like I do. And so I you know, picked up the method as part of my training, and then decided that it was the way to go for this particular book.
Okay, very cool. Sorry, I work in the modern era in like American studies, so it's a much different landscape. So it's cool that you have these different levels of training and these different approaches, and I think it's helpful for historians to branch out into these different periods just to be able to understand each other and stuff. So thank you for that insight. Let's move to chapter 4 now and kind of move from books to maps and understanding both the cosmos and geography. Do you want to talk about this chapter and how medieval authors claim that there were more water on Earth and that this water was located in the southern hemisphere?
Sure. So this particular chapter that Aspen has asked about is focused specifically on cosmographical and geographical texts. So texts that talk about the layout of, you know, what we would call the globe. So the relationship basically between water and land masses and the connection between the globe, the Earth, and how it relates to other planets in the cosmos. And so these texts, there's a lot of discussion, right? So they talk about these topics. And then in the 16th century, they start to circulate with these wonderful, beautiful maps, with which I have to say I'm very obsessed and was sad that I did not get to do more of, I didn't get to work with them as much as I'd like in the book. But what I found first in terms of the text, there's a similar thing going on in these geographical and cosmographical works in the 16th century, as I found with the exegetical works. they are much more interested in the question of why water doesn't flood the earth than earlier authors were. And they're also much more likely to call it a miracle, as we heard Martin Luther do. But this starts to shift. They come to this idea that, okay, the surface of the earth must be made up of a combination of land and water. And you start to see this in the 1520s. So early in the 16th century, this is what they're writing about. But when you look at the maps, specifically in this book, I looked at the world maps, you start to find that this idea of water, it really comes out, especially if you look at the southern hemisphere on these maps, because the maps themselves have a bunch of land in the northern hemisphere, and then in the water, or the southern hemisphere, excuse me, there's so much water that for those map makers who were so inclined, they tend to put cute little and sometimes ferocious little sea monsters in the southern hemisphere in order to fill up what, you know, some of them probably saw as a blank space. And I took that and I argue that that's a further sign that they, even though they're like, okay, right, we're got this new idea of Earth as a combination of water and land, but they're still sort of grappling visually with where to put all the water that they think must be in the globe.
Yeah, that's so interesting to think of. I mean, because I never realized it before, but I've totally taken for granted the fact that I know that our planet is so wet and it's full of so much water. Whereas if you're living back then, it wasn't apparent. And one thing I was kind of thinking of, kind of juxtaposing the water with land is the idea of like wasteland. And did, as they were interpreting water, did they see water as just kind of this desert, or was it more of a just waste of space, or was it just divine power or somewhere in the middle, or none of those at all?
I think, to be honest, it's all of the above.
Okay,
I think
cool.
Yeah, I think water was very mysterious to 16th century Europeans. I was at a conference once, and one of the participants in my panel, I was talking actually about the sea monsters on some of these maps, and she looked at me and she said, "Well, you art what you eat, right? So you draw what you eat, basically." And so some of the stuff they might know, because a lot of places obviously relied on seafood as part of their diet. But once you get deeper out into the ocean, I mean, they have no idea what lies under the ocean surface. And so it is a great mystery, one that they tend to fill, at least in the 16th century, they often fill oceans that are not particularly well known. So what we would call the Pacific Ocean or the Indian Ocean, they fill them with really, really scary sea creatures. Whereas like the Mediterranean Sea, sometimes they'll draw some sea creatures there and they're like really kind of cuddly looking. There's this old idea that goes back to ancient Romans, and probably even before that, that if there's a land version of the animal, there'll be a sea version of the animal as well. And so I've seen maps where there's like a dogfish and it looks like, you know, like a mammal dog with like a fin tail. And so they put those in the Mediterranean Sea, but they put scary ship crushing monsters in the Pacific and the Indian Ocean, because they don't know them very well in this period.
Oh my gosh, I love that so much, and that really does speak to the way that they classified things. My specialty is in botany, so what I've learned in the 15th century and before, and 16th century and before, is that they were classifying things based on what the plant looked like and things like that. And so the fact that they're translating that then to these unknowns is really, really fascinating. And I guess just because we are getting short on time, and I want to try and cover as much as possible. Jumping to kind of chapter seven and really thinking about these, it's the title of chapter seven is Sea Voyages and the Water Earth Relationship. And this is where you're really getting into this expanded world with Africa and South America and the Pacific. And I mean, this is a pretty transformational moment for how Europeans begin to reorder it. I guess, is it a transformational moment when Europeans begin to reorder the world, or is this, would you argue, it's just a continuation of what's been happening since like the medieval period?
Yeah, I think it's, again, sorry to pull I tell my students the thinky professor thing, but I think it's a little bit of both.
Perfect. I'm all about the gray spaces.
Exactly. Yeah, me too. So I think it's a little bit of both. I think on the one hand, there has been long-standing interest in voyages, right? There's certainly many medieval voyages to the islands off the coast of Africa, for example, and to Africa and, you know, up even into the Atlantic and up kind of through the English Channel. So there's lots of interest in these voyages beforehand. There's lots of interest in the layout of the world. And so I think in that sense, these 16th century authors continue that interest. What I think is different for them is they have new information, both coming from newly discovered texts, right? So texts that medieval scholars did not have access to because of, they weren't discovered or printed yet. And also the information that is coming from these voyages, which are, again, circulating very widely in texts. They become they become bestsellers in the 16th century, stories of voyages, which are things that medieval scholars did not have access to. And so that sort of changes then how they think about the world.
Wow, that's really insightful and a really interesting perspective into how knowledge and worldviews are created and how complex they really are when we start really digging into questioning why and what we know. And I think this kind of leads back to your afterword and really take understanding water in our own world and looking at something like Blue Humanities to help us deal with these water crises as well as bookish methods. Moving forward, if you were to encourage like your students to think about water in a different way based off of this book and all of the research and insight that you can provide, would you mind just, you know, enlightening us?
Sure. So I think what I would advise, I am obviously a Europeanist, and there's of course nothing wrong with that. But what I would urge students in the future to do is to focus on other geographical areas, specifically places where their water has been, for lack of a better word, used and abused specifically by colonial powers. I was very struck by a book by a person named Rob Nixon. It's called Slow Violence and the Environmentalism of the Poor. And it talks about how even after colonial regimes leave places, the damage that they have done to the environment remains. And doing some work on these areas in order to kind of just learn the scope of the damage and also looking at kind of local people's water management knowledge would be a really useful and really fruitful line of research, I think.
Yeah, that sounds really useful and a good way to go. And well, and this has been such a wonderful interview, and thank you so much for coming on to talk about your new book. And before we go, we do like to ask our traditional closing question about what are you up to next?
Yeah, I appreciate the question. So one of the major questions that has driven my work and my interest in the intersection of the history of religion and the history of science is the question of how do we come to know things, both as an individual? Like, how do you get to that moment as an individual where you say, I know this thing? As well as how do we get to that point as human communities? And that's what led me to the 16th century in general for my area of focus, because I think, as we've discussed, so much is in flux with the encounters with all of these peoples and places that Europeans had never known existed before. And with my next project, I'd like to continue to explore that topic by looking at specifically notions of kind of human perception and how that shapes what we know. So linkages between bodies and knowledge, and specifically how, you know, who can know, what they can know, what is considered knowledge, how that has often been gendered. And so that's where my research is moving next.
Eek, I'm so excited to see how what you come up with. That sounds so fascinating. Well, Lindsay, thank you so much for coming on today. We sure appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. I really enjoyed this, and I really appreciate all of your enthusiasm for my work and your questions.
Oh, well, it's been my pleasure, and I do encourage everybody to go and check out Encountering Water in Early Modern Europe and Beyond, published by Amsterdam Press or University Press in 2020. Thank you so much, and have a great day, Lindsay.
Thank you. You too, Aspen.
Thank you.